This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Our guest has several decades of experience in water management and agriculture. Reagan Wascom is the director of the Colorado Water Institute and chair of the Colorado State University Water Center in Fort Collins. Dr. Wascom, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. And my first order of business is trying to establish whether the drought in California is part of the larger pattern of drying in the West, especially in the Southwest. What do you think?
Well, I think we've definitely been in an extended dry period since around 2000, I would say. But it's really difficult to say what next year holds or what the next decade holds. So will this persist? To be determined is what I would say.
Right. I have seen media reports with headlines saying the California drought could be part of a 100-year event or even several hundred years. Is there a scientific basis to those kind of worries?
Well, I think it's important for your listeners to distinguish between what we mean when we say a 100-year event versus a 100-year drought. And so you often hear this term of 100-year event around floods, and we use it around droughts. And really, that's a probabilistic way of expressing the severity of an event. So when we say a 100-year flood, we mean there's a 1% probability of that happening in any given year. So looking at the California drought from that point of view, is this the 1% drought? Very well could be. We'll see what comes next. Is it part of a 100-year drought? Unlikely. However, we know that in the paleo record, there are some very long droughts that have occurred in the Southwest, particularly in the 1100s and 1300s.
So how does that compare to what happened in the 1930s Dust Bowl times? Do you know?
Yeah, so the 30s Dust Bowl really had its center very close to Colorado, kind of in the Colorado, Oklahoma, Texas, New Mexico area. So even though there's not very many people left that lived it, we still refer to the 30s and the 50s droughts as sort of our droughts of record, and we do a lot of our water resources planning based upon those events because we know what they look like. And this one, I think, you know, certainly this long dry period, the severity is very high, okay, and I think that's important to understand. The duration is not yet equal to a 30s or a 50s drought. And so when you look at, you know, the damage that drought caused, you look at both the intensity and the duration that gets us there. Now, a caveat on that statement is what's really different between the 30s and now is look at the people, right? We have many more people. Our infrastructure is very different. And so events like this can put a lot more people into jeopardy, I guess is what I would say. So that's the big difference. Whether this ends up being a 30 or 50s drought will really depend on what next year brings us.
Well, and just looking at the household's use of water, I mean, we've got washing machines and dishwashers and all sorts of things that in the 1930s they just didn't have.
Yeah, that's right. Our water footprint is much higher than it was in 1930, no doubt.
So California and Colorado have a history of water agreements and projects. Is the Colorado water supply important to farming in California, or are they not related?
No, they're absolutely related relative to the Colorado River. So the Colorado River originates in Wyoming, Colorado. And, you know, we figure that the river yields about 14 to 15 million acre feet every year, and 8 to 9 of that does come out of Colorado. So we are very closely connected, although there's quite a bit of distance spatially between us. So the Southern California irrigation districts, and by that I mean Palo Verde, the Imperial District, Coachella, these rely on Colorado River water that originates here in Colorado. Central Valley, where you're hearing of a lot of the disruption right now, that's not connected to Colorado. But we certainly have a strong and long relationship between Colorado and California.
So I have to ask, how are the reservoirs and snowpacks in Colorado this year? What with the polar vortex and all that?
Yeah, great question. So, you know, we're sitting here in late February right now, and we have a little bit above average snowpack in the central and northern part of Colorado that will deliver water downstream to California. Southwest is still dry. And if you look at the climatology, you know, if you look at the last 24-month precipitation index or 48, we're still dry here. There's no doubt about that. So we've got a deficit. Snowpack looks good. We're above average. A lot of the year's left, and we can talk about what March and April can do to that snowpack. Reservoirs, we're about half full, I'd say, which is not too far off of where we like to be going into the spring snowmelt. We'd like to have a little bit more in our reservoirs, and certainly the big Colorado River reservoirs are in deficit, and that's what troubles us, is Lake Powell and Lake Mead and those reservoirs that are so important to the operation of the Colorado River system. And then just one more point about snowpack is that March and April can make us or break us. And by that, I mean, if you look at the drought years of 2002 or 2012, which were pretty heavy-duty droughts up in this neck of the woods, if it turns off warm and dry in April, we can see a lot of our snowpack just evaporate, go up into the sky, and never get into the rivers. And so we kind of just hold our breath and wait till we get into mid-April to really know what we've got for a water supply.
So that's still to be determined. Well, I'd like to draw also on your expertise in agriculture. Can you tell us about the chain of impacts on farming and farming communities when a drought like this strikes?
So ag is a really big and diverse sector, and it's hard to talk about it monolithically. And so what I would say is that in a lot of the Southwest, a great deal of the land mass is devoted to grazing and ranching, and a lot of the public lands are used for grazing animals. And so those folks feel drought quite a bit differently because, for the most part, they're not irrigating and they're running their animals out on the range. And those ranges and those forests are very susceptible to drought, and the yield of the forage is greatly damaged. And what ends up happening is these ranchers have to sell off their herds. They've either got to feed them, buy hay and feed them, or they sell them. And they'll try first to buy hay, but it becomes very expensive, and then they have to sell their herds. And they build these herds over decades. And so, when you start selling your breeding livestock, you're really selling your equity. So we've seen a lot of displacement in terms of cow-calf herds up here in the upper basin of the Colorado River, and some of them will not come back. So we're seeing that sort of big change on grass-fed animals. When you look at irrigated crops and even the dry land crops, different economy. If you're growing vegetable crops, for example, or fruit, you have a market that you're trying to hit, and you generally have close relationships with the people who buy your specialty crops. And so drought can ace you out of that. I mean, they're going to put the food in the stores to the extent they can. And so if you can't deliver your lettuce or whatever, the buyers at Safeway and Ralph's and other places will go find that food somewhere else. So the value chain, it's a long value chain from what happens in the field all the way to what happens in the grocery store. And, think about the clothes you're wearing, right? You got a cotton shirt on, maybe a wool vest and leather shoes, right? So it's not just their food, it's our clothes, and there's bioenergy, and there's a lot of things connected to agriculture. And it's true, rural communities and agriculture are very tightly connected. And so there's a labor force there that's going to be impacted. And then there's the folks in town who sell fertilizers and cars and tractors. And so these things ripple, particularly through rural communities and smaller communities, I would say. And we see incomes drop and jobs just go away. So it's significant.
Yes, in Australia, some of the farmers did have to give up due to a long-term drought. There was a rash of bankruptcies and suicides, and I'm hoping that won't happen in the United States. But if this sticks with us for another, say, 5 years, do you think it's possible that we'll just have to rethink our way of farming?
Well, it's certainly possible. I mean, to be honest, Alex, we saw this in the 2002 drought on the Great Plains. We saw people lose the farm. We saw people having mental health problems, and we did see suicides, unfortunately. The thing about the U.S. that I think we need to keep in perspective is that U.S. ag is a big distributed system, and it's very rare to see the whole country in drought. It's happened before, but it's rare. And so usually, if the Corn Belt is in drought, the Southwest is not, or something like that. So because of that distributed system, we have a really healthy agriculture. I think what's on the radar for folks now is so much of our fruits and vegetables come from California, and the whole state of California is in drought, and we know that that is going to be disruptive to the food chain.
Now, I realize you're not a climate scientist, actually, but surely questions about changing climate must come up for anyone studying water cycles. Do you think climate change is part of the recent drought in California?
Yeah, so I am thinking about climate change and agriculture and water supply all the time. It's something you have to do if you're realistic about these fields. And I think your question is a good one. My answer would be that attribution of a single event, a single phenomenon like this drought to climate change, there's an awful lot of uncertainty in that kind of attribution. You know, weather happens, extreme events happen and have always happened. And I think the unfortunate thing is we won't know whether this is a climate change drought until we're looking at it in the rearview mirror, right? The certainty comes in the future. So I don't really like to get into attribution of single events, but as we start to put these things together and as we begin to understand what warming the surface of the Earth does to the ratio of precipitation to evaporation, you know, we become concerned about the background climate, right? Growing aridity, and then you can layer drought on top of that. But it's important to understand that drought's a phenomenon that occurs, always has occurred. Background aridity is something different that may be worth talking about.
This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking with Professor Regan Wascom from Colorado about the general drought in the Southwest. And you know, we hear a lot about city residents, how they should go for drought-friendly landscaping instead of thirsty lawns or change shower heads. And most of my listeners are in the cities. But isn't it true that agriculture drinks up to about 80% of the fresh water we get? What can we do to change the farming practices in order to cope?
It is true that in the West, ag probably uses 80%. That's probably a pretty darn good number. It varies from place to place. So first thing is, if you're going to grow food crops or feed crops in a desert or an arid environment, it takes a lot of water. That's just a given. So, you know, to really change that footprint in a big way means that we have to think about moving those crops somewhere else. But I think your question is, what can we do given where we're growing crops now and the way that we're irrigating them? And there are things that we can do. I would say there's no free lunch, but what you're seeing, a transition in agriculture to a much more efficient system. We're putting in a lot more sprinkler irrigation, drip irrigation, looking at water savings practices, looking at crop varieties and types that use less water. Farmers know how to deal with drought, and they do it by cutting back their demand, cutting back how much they grow. Again, the question is long-term. What do we do if we need to move water, or if we want as a society to move water to cities as opposed to grow food? How do we do that? How do we make that transition in a way that's productive and we don't lose the value of those landscapes, those working lands? So it's tough. We can do it, and we are doing it, though, through technology for the most part.
Well, still on the topic of the way we use water, there's been controversy about using precious fresh water for shale gas fracking in Colorado and elsewhere, even as the groundwater supplies are falling. I've heard that you've been studying that. What can you tell us at this point?
Yes, so CSU here, Colorado State, is part of a larger National Science Foundation study that we're doing with the University of Colorado, and actually Cal Poly Pomona is part of that. And we're looking at just this question that you ask. So there is a water footprint to shale gas. And yes, in some places, folks are using, you know, treated municipal water in order to do hydraulic fracturing and to complete those wells. I think that where we need to go is really closing that loop to where we are recycling all the produced water that comes out of these oil and gas wells, all of the frack flowback water. So we capture it, treat it, use it again, and close that loop. And we've got a long way to go in that regard. The technology's there. It's a matter of whether it's cost-effective enough or whether regulations push the industry to where instead of using freshwater supplies, they use that brackish water that's associated with oil and gas that has little value in the municipal or industrial or agricultural market. So long way to go. We're studying it. You know, we've got to get the treatment loop cost-effective and closed, and it'll be some time before we get there.
Well, if this drought becomes the new normal in California, I mean, you have some wet years, but too many dry years, can we move those crops elsewhere in the country?
That is a really interesting question. Yes, but. And the but is, you know, California has that Mediterranean climate that's very unique and lends itself to growing a number of specialty crops that we highly value. And I think it will be quite interesting to see how, as climate change warms the country, how crops and livestock production patterns shift and change. And they will move northward, and they will move around, and they will move to where there's adequate water supplies, because food's basic, right? We've got to eat, and we will eat. The question of, you know, are we going to be growing artichokes in Iowa? I kind of doubt it. I think it's more likely they'll go to Chile or Mexico or some other place where they're better suited. So you can't make a complete substitution of what we're doing in California elsewhere. It will push northward, is what I would say.
Well, now, you've taught a lot of students and graduate students, and just on a personal level, do you think young people are more disconnected from natural reality now than when you were growing up, or is that just a myth older people always tell themselves?
You know, that's a great question, and it does trouble me, and here's what I would say to you is that the students that we have here at Colorado State University in our natural resources colleges, I mean, they are so engaged, and they are so intentional about our environment and natural resources and their desire to make a better world there, that when, you know, that's the reward of being a university prof, right, is you get to work with that youth and passion and enthusiasm. And so I see a cadre of really bright, great students coming along. If you're asking me that question about society at large, troubles me, absolutely. And I don't think that you can really have a virtual relationship with nature. I think you've got to get out there and mess around. And that's what I want our students to do, and that's what I want all young people to do, is to know nature firsthand. And so I get the gist of your question, and yeah, it is a concern I think we should have as a society.
Well, there's a movement now in Vancouver and around the country to reconnect people with farmers, with the people who grow their food, because let's face it, chickens don't come frozen in the supermarket. They come from somewhere, and so we're going to have to pay attention to these long weather systems.
Absolutely, and one of the bumper stickers I'm seeing here in Colorado is one that just says, "Who's your farmer?" and challenging people to connect, not just to who's growing your food, but how are they growing it? Where are they growing it? And what does that mean for me individually? So it is a neat movement that's going on.
As we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners?
I just would thank them for listening and for wanting to dig in deeper beyond the sound bites. And I guess I'd thank them for caring about this place where we live.
I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. We've been talking about the big picture of water in the West with the longtime expert, Dr. Regan Wascom. He's the director of the Colorado Water Institute and chair of the Colorado State University Water Center in Fort Collins. Dr. Wascom, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
It's been fun, Alex.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.